ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जायमुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवत सेवया भगवतीरुत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्टिकी कृष्णाय वासुदेवाय देवकीनन्दनाय च नन्दगोपकुमाराय गोविन्दाय नमो नमः। हरे कृष्ण। ग्रन्थराज श्रीमद्भागवतम् Canto 10, Chapter 47, Verse 28. Shruyatam priya sandesho, bhavati naam sukhavaha, yamadaya gato bhadra, aham bharto rahaskaraha, shruyatam priya sandesho, भवतीनां सुखावह यमादाय गतो भद्रा अहं भर्तु रहस्करः श्रूयतां प्रियसन्देशो भवतीनां सुखावह यमादाय गतो भद्रा अहं भर्तु रहस्करः Translation. Shruyatam. Please hear. Priya. Of your beloved. Sandeshaha. The message. Bhavati naam. For you. Sukha. Happiness. Avaha. Bringing. Yam. Which. Adaya, carrying, agataha, have come, bhadra, good ladies, aham, I, bhartu, of my master, raha, of confidential duties, karaha, the executor. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Translation. My good ladies, please hear your beloved's message, which I, the confidential servant of my master have come here to bring you. This verse has no purport. So, we'll go to the 29th verse. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha Bhavati Naam Yogo Me Nahi Sarvatmana Kvachit Yatha Bhutani Bhuteshu Khamvayo Agnir Jalam Mahi Tatha Ham Jamana Prana Bhutendriya Guna Ashrayaha. Translation, the Supreme Lord said, you are never actually separated from me, for I am the soul of all creation. Just as the elements of nature, ether, air, fire, water and earth, are present in every created thing, so I am present within everyone's mind, life, air and senses, and also within the physical elements and the modes of material nature. Purport. According to Srila Jiva Goswami and Srila Vishnunath Chakravarti, the apparently philosophical language of the Lord's statement conceals a deeper meaning. The Supreme Lord was secretly telling the gopis that He, by way of reciprocating their special love for Him, was present with them, not only as the soul of all creation, but also as their special lover. In this sense of the words, the word guna indicates the gopis' special divine qualities which attracted Sri Krishna, and the word sarvatmana, which we have here translated in reference to Lord Krishna himself, corresponding to the word me, which is also in the instrumental case, is also understood in the sense of sarvatha or completely. In other words, although in one sense Lord Krishna was absent, he could never be completely absent, since in his spiritual form he is always in the hearts and the minds of the gopis. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, another book, Srila Prabhupada has elaborately explained that the reason Lord Krishna separated himself from the gopis was to intensify their love for him, and as Uddhava noted, to bless other devotees by revealing to them the intensity of the gopis' love. In fact, the Lord was spiritually present with the gopis since they are his eternal associates. Srila Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur further points out that foolish persons will conclude that Sri Krishna's use of philosophical language meant that the Lord was trying to bring the gopis to the point of liberation by explaining basic points of Krishna conscious philosophy. In truth, the gopis are the most exalted liberated souls, and their pastimes with Sri Krishna must be understood with the help of authorized acharyas. When the gopis came for the rasa dance, Sri Krishna tried to preach karma yoga to them, emphasizing ordinary ethics and morality, but the gopis were beyond that. Similarly, Lord Krishna now offers them Jnana Yoga or metaphysical philosophy, but this is also inadequate for the gopis who have achieved spontaneous unalloyed love for Sri Krishna. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupah Kadamaiha Tadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhanvitamscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Iti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So today morning we are discussing from one of the most esoteric sections of the Srimad Bhagavatam, from its 10th canto. So this is the song of the bees, the Bhramar Gita, in the 47th chapter of the 10th canto. Now the Srimad Bhagavatam has 335 chapters. In total it's 12 cantos, among which the Madhurya Rasa, the highest revelation of the Srimad Bhagavatam is talked about primarily in only 7 chapters. It's from 29 to 33 of the 10th canto, which is the Rasa Panchadhyaya, then the 47th chapter, which is the Bhramara Gita, and then the 65th chapter of the 10th canto, which is Balaramji's visit to Vrindavan. So, of course, other places also there are references to the Madhurya Ras. It actually, the first reference in the 10th canto comes in the 19th chapter, where the gopis are remembering Krishna when he is in the forest, and they are meditating on how everybody has the opportunity to serve him. But we do not have that opportunity. Thinking that Krishna is in the forest, and in the forest, the sun is serving him by his warmth. And when the warmth becomes beyond comfort, then the cloud springs into service. And the cloud comes in and then offers a very cooling, soothing shade to Krishna. And then when the shade becomes slightly, then the cold becomes a little uncomfortable, then the sun again takes over and evaporates the cloud, and again the sun starts giving heat. So like this, everybody is serving Krishna, but we do not have the opportunity to serve Krishna. So now here Krishna has departed from Vrindavan, and after he leaves Vrindavan, his heart is still in Vrindavan and he longs to return. Srila Jiva Goswami in Gopal Champu describes how Krishna is torn between the call of duty and the call of love. The call of duty requires him to be in Mathura, because Kamsa had formed alliances with many of the demoniac kings all over the world, and his death at the hands of Krishna would surely be avenged by his allies. And because if Krishna was not there to protect the Mathuravasis, then they would wreak vengeance on the Mathuravasis. And that was actually the external reason why Krishna stayed on in Mathura. The internal reason was that Krishna did not want any more that the sweetness of Raja be disturbed by the attack of any demons. And although many demons came to Raja before Krishna killed Kamsa, but all those demons came individually on an individual mission. They came in, like one demon came alone, and the mission was to kill Krishna. But if now the kings would come, the kings, knowing Krishna's prowess, would not come alone. They would bring their huge armies. And we know how Jarasandha brought huge armies 17 times to attack Krishna and to destroy the Vrajavasis. So Krishna did not want the sweetness of Raja to be disturbed by such invasions. And that's why, putting a stone on his heart, he told Nanda Maharaj that my elders here in Mathura are asking me, do not go back, please stay here and protect us. He said, I will kill the demons and then I will come back. And Nanda Maharaj practically swooned, fell unconscious, unable to tolerate the thought of separation from Krishna. And Krishna gave mementos for everyone. He said, how will Yashoda live without you? And then Krishna gave parts of his own dress which Yashoda Mai had stitched for him. And he says, this dress will carry the fragrance of my body, and let this be the remembrance for Yashoda Mai. And then Nanda Maharaj said, but how will the gopas live in separation? How will the cows live in separation from you? So Krishna told that Subala looks very similar to me, and I will give him all my dress. And because he looks similar to me, and because my dress will have my fragrance, the cows will think that I am still there. And in that way, they will be pacified. So Krishna gave mementos for all his loved associates. But he could not give any mementos for the gopis. Because Krishna's relationship with the gopis was not official. He had not married the gopis. So, he could not very well give any token to them. And of course, in Vrindavan, just before Krishna departed, evam bruvanam viraha turabhrisham. So, when Krishna was about to depart, at that time, the gopis, evam viraha turabhrisham viraha atura. They became agitated, intolerably agitated by the prospect of separation from Krishna. Visrujjalajjam rudu susmaran. Visrujjalajjam. So, till then, Krishna's rendezvous, meetings with the gopis, were secret. They would meet in private, in the forests, or at various occasions, but not publicly. But here, when the gopis saw that Krishna is about to depart, and thinking that we will never get to see him, so, visrujjalajja. The word lajja here doesn't exactly mean shame, it means modesty. So in Vedic culture, you know, man and women don't exhibit their attraction to each other, even when they are married publicly. What to speak of if they are not yet married. So therefore, visrujjalajja. But here, the gopis, although they never publicly exhibited their attraction, here they visrujja. They said, what is the use of modesty if the very basis of our life is lost from us? Therefore, visrujjalajjam. They put aside their... And rudus smaran, crying, they called out to Krishna. And Krishna, seeing their agony, promised that I will soon come back. So, he has promised this and then he has departed. So, the 39th chapter is the last chapter of Krishna in Vrindavan. The 40th chapter is Uddhava's prayers, when he sees Krishna's Vishwarup in Yamuna. That marks the transition. And now we are here in the 47th chapter. So in between, what all has happened since Krishna departed? Krishna has, not only Krishna departed, after the return news came that Krishna will come later. So now often we know that when people say later, it means never. You know, tomorrow has no end. So the gopis were agonized. Will Krishna never come back? So Krishna was in Mathura, and then from there the Vrajavasis, the Mathuravasis told him that now it is our responsibility, you are our son. So we should get you initiated, we should get you educated. Now of course Krishna is supremely educated, but as a matter of duty, Krishna went from Mathura to Avantipur, what is modern day Ujjain. And the Vrajavasis had no news. Where is Krishna? Krishna seems to have disappeared. And when Krishna returned, at that time his heart was eager to go to Vraja. So when his initiation ceremony happened, at that time Krishna wanted the Vrajavasis also to come. But the Mathuravasis were always fearful. You know, even when Krishna is not seeing the Vrajavasis, he is so attached to them. If he sees them, he will leave us and go away. So therefore, they told him, please don't call the Vrajavasis. And then, Krishna consulted Balramji. And he said, you know, I cannot live any longer in separation. So please, maybe one day, I will just secretly slip away from here. And you act as a cover for me. You tell me that I am with you, and I will just go. So Balramji said, let us talk with Rohini about this. Now, actually among the various associates of Krishna, apart from Balaramji, the only associate who is in both Vrindavan and Mathura Dwarka pastimes is Rohini. So, Rohini says, I have also thought about this. I have seen how much you are afflicted in separation from Krishna, from Rajivasis. But the Mathuravasis are constantly keeping watch on you. And you can slip away from their watch, but it is not good for you to disobey your elders, your father, your mother. So then Krishna decided to send Uddhava. And when Uddhava comes, the previous chapter describes how he pacified the elders, especially Yanda Maharaj Yashodamai. And in this chapter, it's described how he meets with the gopis. Now interestingly, this chapter has two distinct parts. The first part is the premonmad, the intoxication of love that characterizes Radharani, wherein she sees Uddhava and her heart is torn. On one side, she is eager. What is the message that Krishna has sent? On the other hand, she thinks, no, Krishna has disappointed us. He has devastated us. Again, if I hear his message, our hopes will be raised. And again, those hopes may be crashed. So better I don't want to hear the message at all. And she expresses the agony of her heart by considering a honeybee as a messenger of Krishna. Now the acharyas describe that actually that can be either a random honeybee who is just flying around and Radharani thinks that this is a messenger of Krishna. The other is that actually that honeybee has come from Mathura. And third is that Krishna himself has come in the form of the honeybee. And Yashoda and Radharani speaks this and her heart is expressed, and after that Uddhava is stunned to see the exaltedness of the love of Radharani. And now he is about to speak. So now the whole purpose of Uddhava's visit is to give this message to Radharani or to Gopis and Rajivasis. But it's again interesting that this chapter is not titled as Krishna's message to the Gopis. It is titled as the Brahmaragita, the song of Devi. So the chapter has these two parts. The song of Devi part is, the Brahmaragita is over already. Now, the part about Krishna's message is coming. So among both these parts are important. But in terms of the Bhagavatam's mood, the Bhagavatam's mood is that the Bhagavata conquers the heart of Bhagavan. And that's why the Bhagavata is actually higher than Bhagavan. And that's why we will see, for example, the 7th canto. In terms of drama, dramatic entry and action, it is Narasimhadev who is most prominent. He appears in the 8th chapter. And he delivers Hiranyakashipu. Now, delivers is a delicious euphemism for killing. So, euphemism means to speak something which is unpalatable in a relatively softer way. So, delicious is a deliver is a delicious euphemism for kill. So he kills him in the 8th chapter. In the 9th chapter there are the prayers that are offered. In the 10th chapter, Narasimhadev responds and he departs. So, Narasimhadev is there only for 3 chapters, but Prahlad is there right from the 1st chapter till the, not just the 10th chapter, he reappears in the 8th canto also, in the chapter 24, when he offers prayers to Vamanadev. So, to forgive Bali Maharaj. So the point is that, in terms of overall narrative, it is Prahlad who steals the show, who is the hero. Similarly, here in the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, it is the gopis and it is Radharani who is the centerpiece. And that's why the chapter is entitled not as Uddhava Sandesh, although that can also be a title. It is entitled primarily as Bhramara Gita. So now, the Bhramara Gita is over and Krishna's message is about to be delivered by Uddhava. So Uddhava speaks, Shruyatam Priya Sandesho Shruyatam. So Shravan is to hear. Shruyatam means please hear. Priya Sandesho, the Sandesha, the message of your beloved, please hear this. Bhavati Nam. So in Sanskrit, unlike in English, there are variants for expressing degrees of respect in second person. So for example, if I want to express in second person, I will say he. Now in the past, in English, sometimes people would use they to refer to somebody respectable. So for example, if there is some emperor, now the emperor is referring to himself, Ham Vahan Aa Jayenge. So actually singular should be mai, but there is that element of respect, so where one uses a plural to use a singular. But that's because it's a limitation of the language. Actually it's there in English, so he is there. But in Sanskrit, there is for the second person, Tvam and Bhavan. So Tvam is an ordinary second person reference. Bhavan is a respectful second person reference. So first person is I, second person is you, and third person is he or she. So here, Bhavati Naam. Now from the point of view of worldly relationships, Uddhava is both learned and powerful. He is very, very learned, being a disciple of Brihaspati, and he is one of the Yadus. As compared to that, the gopis are just unknown cowherd girls. But Uddhava knows that the true standard of respect is based on one's respect for the Supreme Lord. So how is one's relationship with the Supreme Lord? How much one loves the Supreme Lord? And that's why, although the gopis from the worldly hierarchy are below him, from the devotional hierarchy, they are far, far above him. Bhavati Naam. That's why, the respectful second person. Sukhavaha. Sukhavaha. Bringing happiness. So, Jiva Goswami explains that this message of Krishna will relieve the gopis of some of their separation. And that's why Sukhavaha, it will bring happiness. Another meaning he gives is that, Vaishnava Toshani explains that actually the gopis have vented, especially Radharani, have vented their anger caused by separation from Krishna. And after venting that anger, they have become really little pacified. And so now that you have become a little emotionally stabilized, now I will speak this message. Sukhavaha. And Yamada Yagato Bhadra Ada Yagato. So I have come carrying this message. So it's interesting that normally a messenger is not considered to be a very important person. Krishna becomes the Shanti Dhuta when he wants to take the peace message of the Pandavas to the Kauravas. And of course, the messenger is respected. But normally, we have people who are, in English they are called errand boys. You know, there are in the past people where somebody has to carry an errand. Okay, send this message to that person. So you write something and give it to that person. So they are not considered very respectable. So, but when there is something very important to be done, then at that time, that message has to be entrusted to a very important person. So he says, I have come carrying this message. Bhartu Rahaskaraha. My masters, I am his confidential servant. So now, is it a matter of pride to say that, you know, I am a confidential servant? You know, if I say that, I am an intimate disciple of my spiritual master. I say, what is this? How can you say something like this? It will be inappropriate. So how is it that Uddhava is saying, Aham Bhartu Rahaskaraha, I am a confidential messenger. Actually, we see the same theme in the 9th chapter of the first canto, when Bhishma is trying to pacify Yudhishthir after the Kurukshetra war. And he says, Athape kanta bhakteshu pashya bhupanu kampitam yanme sunstajatah sakshat krishno darshanam agatah. So he is telling Yudhishthir that ultimately everything happens by the plan of the Lord, and all that we can do, we cannot understand the plan of the Lord, but all that we can do is act according to his plan. And if we act according to his plan, eventually how everything is for the good will be revealed. So, Krishna's actions may not always be pleasant, but they are always benevolent. Pleasant means that which feels good. Benevolent means that which does good. So to illustrate this point, what he is saying over here, see, I had to fight against my beloved Lord. And can you imagine how difficult it must have been for Bhishma to shoot arrows at the Lord who was the ultimate object of love for him? But he did that. And he says, Tathapi ekanta bhakteshu. I was his ekanta bhakta. Ekanta bhakteshu. And then, Pashya bhupanukampitam bhupa, or ruler of the earth, anukampitam, just see what mercy he has bestowed upon me. What is that mercy? Sakshat Krishna darshanam agataha. When I am about to depart from this world, Krishna has himself come and is present, giving his darshan. So, here, Bhishma is saying that I am ekanta bhakteshu. I am an unalloyed devotee. But the focus or the purpose of this statement is not that I am such a great devotee. The focus is that those who are unalloyed devotees are wonderfully rewarded by the Lord. So I practice unalloyed devotion and just see the mercy the Lord has bestowed. That is, he has come and given his darshan to me. So the implication there is that, oh Yudhishthir, you also be a ekanta bhakta. You also practice unalloyed devotion because you will also be rewarded by the Lord eventually. So, when the principle of bhakti or when the mercy of the Lord is to be glorified, at that time, if the context requires, the devotee may glorify oneself also. So, Bhishma is glorifying his unalloyed devotion to demonstrate the Lord's undoubtable reciprocation. That the Lord will surely reciprocate. So similarly, here when Uddhava is saying, Bhartu Rahaskaraha, he is saying, implying by that, actually, you are very dear to the Lord. And because you are very dear to him, that's why he has sent a confidential servant of his. So, his declaring that I am a confidential servant is to serve the mission of the Lord. The mission of the Lord is actually to pacify and encourage the gopis, to remove their sorrow. And for that, if it is required, he is ready to do that. So, the essence of humility is neither self-glorification nor self-condemnation. It is Krishna glorification. Now, humility doesn't mean that I have to think that I am worthless or I have to keep saying that I am worthless. I have to focus. Humility simply means that humility enables us to move away from self-absorption and to move towards Krishna absorption. So, if for the service of the Lord, it is required that a devotee speak one's own glories, then the devotee is ready to do that. There are so many instances. The Bhagavad Gita says, Amanitvam. That one should be humble. In fact, that is the beginning of knowledge. So, actually every day, I write a small meditation on the Bhagavad Gita, on GitaDaily.com. So today only I wrote the article about how humility is not, should not be a justification for shirking responsibility. It should be the inspiration for embracing responsibility. What does it mean? Humility should not be the justification for shirking responsibility. That means if I start thinking that, hey, I am so fallen, if I am given some service, and if I start thinking I am so fallen, I can't do this service. Well, the service has to be done, isn't it? So, if, yes, I am not qualified for doing a service, but then, if Krishna is entrusting me the service, then I should do the service. So that's a very nice anecdote of Srila Prabhupada, along with one of his disciples, I think Mahavishnu Maharaj. So when Mahavishnu Maharaj was in London, at that time, Prabhupada wanted him to start preaching. And he said, Prabhupada, I am so new, I don't know the philosophy. He says, I don't have faith in myself. And Prabhupada looked at him and said, do you have faith in me? He said, yes, of course, Prabhupada, I have full faith in you. And Prabhupada says, if you have faith in me, then you should have faith in my judgment. And I have faith in you. So, I have faith in you, and if you have faith in me, therefore you should have faith in yourself. So, a devotee's self-confidence comes from understanding the self's connection with Krishna. It is not independent self-confidence that I can do great things, but by Krishna's mercy, I can do whatever is required. So humility should not be a justification for shirking responsibility. It should be the inspiration for embracing responsibility. Now, if I am very self-centered, then my only basis for deciding whether I can do something or not will be whether I have the ability or not. Or if it is not just I have the ability, if I do the service, will I get some glory or not? But if my focus is the connection with Krishna, then I know that if Krishna wants me to do something, then Krishna will empower me to do it. Krishna will give me whatever is required, and therefore I can do the service. So, same way when we talk about the 10th canto here, Rahaskaraha. So, Yudhava is saying, I am a confidential servant. This is a confidential section of the Bhagavatam going on. So, the 10th canto is a confidential section of the Bhagavatam. So, on my website, The School Scientist, I often answer questions. So, recently one devotee asked a question. Now, this devotee is connected not just with ISKCON, he is also connected with some other Gaudiya Vaishnava institutions. And they talk about Krishna Leela quite frequently. And they often talk about intimate pastimes of Krishna. This is not the Gaudiya Math, this is the non-Gaudiya Math Gaudiya Vaishnavism. That means that which comes from Bhaktivinoda Thakur down, which is there in Vrindavan. So they told this devotee that if you come to ISKCON, you will never become a real Krishna devotee. Because ISKCON has a perpetual phobia for the 10th canto. ISKCON has a phobia for the 10th canto, and the 10th canto is the heart. That's why you will learn about Krishna Bhakti. So, you will never become a proper Krishna devotee if you go to ISKCON. Therefore, come to us. Now, actually speaking, the word phobia essentially means an irrational fear. Now, there is no logic. Now, there is a phobia called arachnophobia. That is fear of spiders. So people sometimes, when they are in their houses, before they sleep, they have to look in every single place where there might be a spider. And they cover all those places, clean all those, only then they can have peace and sleep. Now, actually speaking, spiders are not going to be present if the house is cleaned regularly. And even if spiders are present, they are not really dangerous creatures. But, the very weird word phobia means an irrational fear. So actually speaking, what our acharyas have given us is not a phobia. It's not an irrational fear. It's a rational caution. It's based on rational, intelligent understanding. And it is not a matter of fear. It's a matter of caution. Caution means not that we shouldn't enter something, but we should have a proper reverential attitude. Now, if really there were a phobia to the 10th canto, now Prabhupada has repeatedly said, one should not trespass in the 10th canto. There is the saying, fools rush in where angels fear to tread. So, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur would apply this saying to the context of the 10th canto. And he says, even the angels, they cautiously approach the 10th canto, but people rush to it frivolously, prematurely. So one should not do that. But that doesn't mean that the 10th canto is never to be studied. Prabhupada himself, on one side he said that don't study the 10th canto prematurely. And one should complete all the 9 cantos before studying the 10th canto. But then he himself made the 10th canto available as the Krishna book. And in fact we can say that Prabhupada says don't study the previous 9 cantos before studying the 10th canto. And Prabhupada gives only the 10th canto as the Krishna book. Isn't it? So is Prabhupada contradicting himself? No. It's not a matter of contradiction, it's a matter of comprehension. That actually Prabhupada presents the 10th canto through the Krishna book in a way that is comprehensible for people. So, now if you look at the Bhagavatam itself, there is no inbuilt caution given at the start of the 10th canto or the end of the 9th canto. Now we are coming to a confidential part. Now, beware. It's like, sometimes if there is some government building, then there are certain areas which are available for visitors, but then certain areas, there are no visitors allowed over here. So there is no mark like that at the end of the canto, no visitors allowed, or something like that. It's just a smooth transition. In the 9th canto, basically, the essential flow of the Bhagavatam is, from the 3rd canto onwards, the lives of the various Manus are being described. So, Svayambhu Manu and his descendants are described from the 3rd canto till the 7th canto. So, and then while describing those Manus, the various incarnations of the Lord and the various great devotees of the Lord who appear, they are described. So, in the seventh canto, sorry, not the seventh canto, eighth canto, in the eighth canto, first chapter, it's described how Swayambhuva Manu is delivered. He attains liberation by the grace of Yajna Avatar. And then, after that, the subsequent Manus are described. And so from 8.2 onwards, the subsequent Manus are described, and then actually it goes quite fast, till Vaivasvat Manu. Vaivasvat Manu is the current Manu is going on. And then the descendants of Vaivasvat Manu are described from the ninth canto onwards. So in that there is a description of Lord Ram, there is Parshuram, there are various, there is Ayati, all those pastimes come up. And in that Krishna's pastimes also come up. So the last chapter of the ninth canto is a summary description of Krishna's pastimes. And then Parikshita asks at the start of the tenth canto, he says, please describe in detail the pastimes of Krishna. And that's how the 90 chapters of the tenth canto emerge. So in that sense, there is a smooth chronological and conceptual flow in the Bhagavatam's development. So where does the caution about the 10th canto come about? Now actually, if we see, there has been historically a progressive revolution of Krishna Tattva. The Bhagavatam, as we know, is spoken by or compiled by Vyasadeva in his spiritual maturity. That is described in the 4th, 5th and 6th chapters of the first canto. Now, that is in terms of the compilation of the Bhagavatam. In terms of historical dissemination, the Bhagavatam became prominent roughly in the 9th, 10th century when Sridhar Swami wrote his commentary. Actually, Sridhar Swami's date is historically, there is a wide variation when he appeared. But it can be 9th century onwards to 11th century. Whenever it was 11th, 12th century. So he appeared and he wrote his commentary, Bhavartha Deepika. Now, that's why we see that Ramanujacharya appeared before Sridhar Swami. And Ramanujacharya refers to the themes of the Bhagavatam. But Ramanujacharya never refers to the Bhagavatam directly. In any of his books, leave alone writing a commentary on the Bhagavatam, there is not even a reference to the Bhagavatam in Ramanujacharya's commentary. Why? Because those themes are there elsewhere. But the Bhagavatam itself gained prominence thereafter. Actually speaking, you know, there is a plan of the Lord to reveal the confidential pastimes of Krishna, historically culminating in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's description of the Parakiya Ras. So, the different acharyas were given by the arrangement of the Lord different roles in this mission. So, Ramanujacharya focused on establishing the supremacy of Vishnu. And that's why, for that purpose, the Vishnu Puran was the primary book. And that's why the Sri Sampradaya focuses not on the Bhagavat Puran, they focus on the Vishnu Puran. Now, when Sridhar Swami writes a commentary on the Bhagavatam, that indicates that the Bhagavatam had already gained respect. Isn't it? You know, if some book itself is unknown and somebody says, I'll write a commentary on that book, who will care for that commentary, isn't it? The book is already important and the commentary is written on it. So, Sridhar Swami's commentary became the fundamental commentary, which is referred back by all the previous acharyas. Now, his commentary is very brief. Now, even in his commentary, he doesn't go too much into the Parakiya Ras. The first book which talks about the pastimes of the gopis with Krishna elaborately is Gita Govinda by Jayadev Goswami. Now of course, the Bhagavatam contains an indirect reference to Srimati Radharani, but there are direct references to Radharani also in the Puranas, in the Brahma Puran, the Brahma Vaivarta Puran and the Padma Puran. There are references to the gopis and to Radharani. The Mahabharata of course focuses more on the Pandavas. So, even Krishna's life is not described much in the Bhagavatam. Now, Krishna's life is described to the extent that his life trajectory intersects with the trajectory of the life of the Pandavas. So, there is a supplement to the Mahabharata called the Harivamsha, in which Krishna's pastimes are described. And there also, the description is not much elaborate about the gopis, although there are references to that. But the Gita Govinda is the first book which talks about especially about Radharani specifically, and about their their amorous pastimes. Now, Srila Prabhupada protects us from misunderstanding these pastimes in many ways. In our sampradaya, Srila Prabhupada is the first acharya who uses the honorific for referring to Radha as not just Radha, but as Radharani. And not just as Radharani, Srimati Radharani. You know, in contrast, there are some other Vaishnavas who get a little bewildered. One of my friends who is a Madhva Vaishnava, he said, you know, how is it that in ISKCON, when you refer to Krishna, you have no honorific? No Sri Krishna, no Bhagavan Krishna, just Krishna. He said, this is not proper respect. So it is, you see, that now if you see, when Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur or Jiva Goswami refer to Krishna's consort, they simply refer to her as Radha. They don't refer to her as Radha Rani. So some Gaudiya Vaishnavas say actually using Srimati Radha Rani is a rasabhas. Because Radha is a simple gopi in Vrindavan. And she is not a queen, and she is a very simple cowherd girl. And the whole mood of Vrindavan is the mood of simplicity. So, this usage of Srimati Radharani is not proper. But, actually, to think that Vraja has no opulence is a misunderstanding of the glory of Vraja. Actually, Vrindavan is filled with as much opulence as is required. But, the devotees subordinate all the opulence to the opulence of love. So, for example, we know that just now we recited the Brahma Samhita. So there is this called Kalpataru. There are so many desire fulfilling trees. But you look at the pastimes of Krishna, whether it is Gopal Champu, Anandavan Champu, or whichever books you describe the pastimes, practically nowhere do you see that when the devotees want to serve Krishna, when Radharani wants to cook and offer something to Krishna, she doesn't say, Kalpataru, just provide this so that I can feed it to Krishna. She personally cooks for Krishna. And she takes up anxiety in cooking for Krishna. So, there is the Kalpataru which can provide everything. But the mood of Raja is the mood of personal service. And that's why, although the facilities of opulence are all there, but the devotees consider their personal service to Krishna without any of these accoutrements of, without any of these trappings of opulence, their personal service to Krishna is the greatest offering to Him. And that's why the opulence of Raja is concealed. It is present, but it is concealed. So, the point I am making over here is that it is not that Radharani is just a simple cowherd girl. She is the source of even the goddesses of fortune. Devi Krishnamai Prokta Radhika Paradevata Sarva Lakshmi Mai, Sarva Kanti Sammohini Para. The Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishna's Kaviraj Goswami quotes this verse, Puranic verse. He says, Devi Krishnamai Prokta. She's Krishnamai. She's completely filled with Krishna. And who is this Radhika? Paradevata. She's the supreme goddess. And Sarva Lakshmi Mai, Sarva. All the Lakshmis come from her and are present in her. So actually, Lakshmi Devi is the goddess of fortune. But she doesn't have the fortune of the personal intimate association of Krishna that the gopis have. So the Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune, but the gopis are the super goddesses of fortune. And when Krishna leaves all the gopis to be alone with Srimati Radharani in the Rasa Leela, the 31st chapter it describes, that reveals the glory of Srimati Radharani. So Radharani is not just a super goddess of fortune, she is the supreme goddess of fortune. So there is a goddess of fortune, which is Lakshmi Devi, there is a super goddess of fortune, there is the gopis, and there is a supreme goddess of fortune, that is Srimati Radharani. So, therefore, it is fully appropriate that Radharani be called by the honorific Radharani and also Srimati. And this is especially required because the activities of Radharani can often be misunderstood. Not just activities of Radharani, the activities of pastimes of Krishna and Radharani. And to have the proper respectful attitude, to give us the proper respectful attitude, Prabhupada uses Srimati Radharani. Now in contrast, why does Prabhupada not use any honorific for Krishna? See, Prabhupada does use sometimes Lord Krishna, And Prabhupada actually, what to speak of using some traditional honorific, Prabhupada has coined this phrase, Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, this is a phrase which actually counters both the prevalent misconceptions about God that were there at his times. I mean, Prabhupada was preaching, and of course that is true even today, the primary misconception within India was that the absolute truth is impersonal. So Prabhupada pointed out that personality is a person, he is not impersonal. And the other prominent misconception was the Christian Western thought had come to India, and the Christians had labeled Indians as polytheistic. You know, you worship so many gods. And the polytheism was considered to be very low level. So, Prabhupada counters that, yes, there may be gods, but there is a Godhead. So, the personality as term counters the impersonalist misconception, and the supreme and Godhead counters the polytheistic misconception. So, in this way, both polytheism and monism, monism is everything is one, Brahman, absolute truth, both are countered. So, Prabhupada has his own usage. So, Tamal Krishna Maharaj did his thesis, his PhD thesis in Prabhupada's teachings, and there he says that every Acharya's teachings can be condensed in a Mahavakya. So, Prabhupada's Mahavakya is Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, as far as the ontological position of Krishna is concerned, Prabhupada does demonstrate it very clearly. Now, in some old editions of the Bhagavad Gita, you may see, especially in the fourth chapter, what happens is, there the Blessed Lord says, it is used. So where does this word Blessed Lord come from? So the Blessed Lord, what happened is, in the initial days, when the devotees were editing Prabhupada's books, so at that time they wanted to make, I agree with Prabhupada especially, wanted to make Prabhupada, the Bhagavad Gita translations as very poetic. Because he said Bhagavad Gita is poetry. So he was repeatedly consulting Prabhupada. Prabhupada, can I do like this? Can I do like this? Can I do like this? And Prabhupada initially, because he was just a new devotee and he wanted to engage him in service, Prabhupada encouraged him. Then Prabhupada told him finally, he says, you know, the translation is not all that important. The purport is what is important. So he says, don't spend so much time. He said that, you know, about as far as translation is concerned, just take anyone's translation and put there. Prabhupada, the devotee was shocked. He said, how can I take anyone's translation? That will be plagiarism. You know, plagiarism means you take somebody else's intellectual product, somebody else's writing and publish it as your own. So Prabhupada said, how can it be plagiarism? He said, they are Krishna's words. They are not that commentator's words. So, then what happened is, in the first edition of the Bhagavad Gita, the devotees took things from some other contemporary translation, and that translator had translated Shri Bhagawan, Shri as blessed, and Bhagawan as Lord. That's how the Blessed Lord had come over there. But that's why the later editions of the Bhagavad Gita reflect Prabhupada's will more accurately. And that's why now we have the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, as far as the ontological position is concerned, ontology means the nature of existence. Prabhupada makes it very clear that Krishna is no ordinary being. He is not even an extraordinary being. He is a supreme being. And that is enshrined in his unique phrase, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But at the same time, Prabhupada taught that we have to develop a personal relationship with Krishna. Because ultimately, bhakti, the essence of bhakti is that personal relationship with Krishna. And to demonstrate or to facilitate that personal relationship, Prabhupada talked about Krishna as a very real, vivid person. And that's why Prabhupada himself, oh, Krishna will help you. So Prabhupada, in his conversations, in his lectures, he referred to Krishna in a very intimate, personal sense. So, the intimate personal relationship with Krishna is definitely not lost. In fact, it is very much there. And through Prabhupada's example, you know, Krishna consciousness can be defined in various ways. Somebody can say, always think of Krishna. Always remember Krishna. Be absorbed in Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes. And all those things you can think about Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada gives a very practical definition. And time a devotee asks, what is Krishna consciousness? Prabhupada said that, when you come in the temple, and you take darshan of the deities. At that time, while taking darshan of the deities, if you feel that Krishna is asking me, what are you doing for me? If you have that consciousness, that Krishna wants me to do some service for him, then you are Krishna conscious. So Krishna consciousness doesn't mean that, oh, I always think of Krishna and then always think, what is Krishna going to do for me? No, I think about what I will do for Krishna. And that's why, you know, the Vatsalya Ras, which is among the five rasas, the Vatsalya Ras inverts the normal parental relationship with God. The Vatsalya Ras is, how does it invert? The normal parental relationship is God is the father and we are his children. That is true. But along with that, there is the Vatsalya Ras in which the devotee becomes the parent and the Lord becomes the son. So, the point is the intimacy with Krishna is there, but it is there in a proper way. So now, I was talking about the historical revelation of the intimate pastimes of Krishna. So Radharani comes prominently in Gita Govinda. Now again, if you see Gita Govinda, Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur has explained that it is a book for liberated souls. But now again, you will see that it is not that the Gita Govinda in a preface says, if you are not liberated, you should not read the book. There is nothing like that over there. So, now at that time, it was regularly recited and it became immensely popular when Gita Govinda was written. You know, in today's language, it became a super hit. It became immensely popular. And then afterwards, there were the Vidyapati who wrote his compositions, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu heard his compositions, Chandidas was there. And then of course, the Goswamis wrote compositions describing Radharani's pastimes with Krishna. And they were widely distributed and they were relished. And now, if you see, when there is a culture of reverence, then even when one understands, when one talks about Krishna's intimate pastimes with the gopis, one understands that these are an object of reverence. These are not ordinary. These are transcendental. But from the 17th, 18th century onwards, when the Western people came to India, the West had the presumption of intellectual superiority over India. Now, why intellectual superiority? We have science, we have technology. And relatively speaking, the Britishers had relatively less forces, but they had cannons and other things, other weapons by which they conquered India. So seeing the technology, even Indians started thinking that, that yes, these Europeans are intellectually superior to us. And their attitudes, they had the whole idea of Victorian morality. They said, you know, what is this? Krishna is not married to the gopis and how is he having a relationship with this? All Krishna is an immoral god. And that's when the conception started coming into the Indian thought also. Because prior to that, when Krishna's pastimes, the gopis were described, it was understood that they are not immoral, they are transmoral. If there is moral, below that is immoral. But above moral is transmoral. So, when the gopis, there is one Hindu group who has changed the Bhagavad Gita. You know, how they have changed it? I was hearing a recitation of the Bhagavad Gita. So, so there is this 18.66. Sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam braj. So they have said, sarva adharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam braj. They say, how can God tell you to give up dharma? There's a mistake over there. There has to be one over there. Sarva adharman parityaja. So that mistake which has come through the tradition, we'll correct it now. But the point is, the Bhagavad Gita is not just talking about giving up adharman. Yeah, it is talking about giving up dharma also. The word dharma is multivalent. Multivalent means it has many meanings. And that's why the word dharma, it means in this context, worldly religiosity. The religiosity which leads to dharma artha kama. That kind of dharma you should give up. And therefore, what should you do? Take up the supreme dharma. What is that supreme dharma? Mamekam sharanam vraja. Take shelter of me alone. So, now, the gopis, what are they doing? When Krishna plays his flute and calls them, here also in the purport is mentioned how Krishna, when the gopis come, he first tells them about karma yoga. You know, how a wife should be devoted to her husband. And therefore, you should go back, you should serve your family members. Krishna tells them that. But, what do the gopis do? The gopis actually reject Krishna's instruction. And they stay on over there. Now if you see, what Krishna tells in the 29th chapter, 29th, 30th chapter of the 10th canto, he also tells the same thing in the 22nd chapter. The 22nd chapter is Krishna's instructions to the Brahmana Patnis. And he tells them to the Brahmana Patnis, now actually it's a great sacrifice of the Brahmana Patnis that when their husbands have turned away Krishna's cowherd Gopas, so the Brahmana Patnis go to Krishna. But Krishna tells them go back. And they go back. But when Krishna tells the gopis go back, gopis don't go back. So what are the gopis doing? Gopis are demonstrating sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam vraja. So all dharmas, so even the dharma of chastity, that which is the highest dharma for a stri, that is to be given up for the sake of Krishna. So it's a principle that is being demonstrated over here. See, there are certain pastimes of Krishna which are models, which are to be literally followed in the footsteps. And there are others which are to be exalted for understanding but not for imitating. That's the difference between Anukaran and Anusaran. Anukaran means just doing what is being done. Anusaran means taking inspiration. So what the gopis do for Krishna, that is not to be imitated. That is to be revered. That is to be exalted. So the gopis, what Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita, the gopis demonstrate. That give up all dharma. Even the dharma of chastity, if that is to be given up for Krishna's sake, one should be ready to give it up. So, that principle is being demonstrated. That's why I said that Krishna's pastimes with the gopis are not immoral. So, immoral means that which is below morality. Transmoral means that which is above morality. The gopis are very devoted, they are diligent in performing their duties. But when Krishna calls, then they take up that call of Krishna. So this is the proper understanding, of course this is just one aspect of the proper understanding, of Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. So what happened is that this was the broad understanding that the gopis are very exalted devotees and their activities with Krishna are not ordinary worldly activities. So that's why there was no aspersion that the gopis' activities with Krishna are immoral. But from the time the Britishers came, then they had their idea of Victorian morality, and they said that, oh, this is an immoral god. So then Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote an essay called The Bhagavata, Its Ethics, Theology and Philosophy. And very celebrated essay. That was the essay that began his, you could say, career as a Gaudiya Vaishnava preacher. So this year is the 100th anniversary of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's disappearance. And so there he explains how Krishna's pastimes, he explains to the people at that time how Krishna's pastimes are actually transcendental. They are not material. So what happened is, prior to that also India was ruled by foreigners, but now when the Muslims were there ruling India, nobody considered them to be intellectual competitors to the Vedic religion. You know, see, somebody can mistake, say, copper to be gold. But you know, nobody will mistake a potato to be gold. So, now, if we see, this is not a disrespect of Islam. You know, there are revelations which are meant to elevate people according to time, place, circumstance. And we see Muhammad, that did a lot of socio-cultural reform during his times. But subsequently what has happened in Islam is that if you see in the Vedic tradition, the Brahmanas and Kshatriyas were always separated. The Brahmanas were the sources of spiritual power, the Kshatriyas were the sources of political power. Now if you see in Christianity also, Jesus was the spiritually potent person, and Christianity was widely spread by St. Paul, who was one of the later apostles, and he was like the center of political power. So the separation of spirituality and political power is essential. But Islam, that has not been there right from the beginning. Muhammad was a spiritual revealer as well as a political ruler. And subsequently, most of the followers, rather than focusing on his spiritual teachings, have focused on his political activism. And that's why Largely, today we see now there are many many people who are sincere seekers within Islam also, but there it has largely become a search for political power under the garb of religion. And then there are various forms of terrorism and other things that come up. So why I am talking about Islam is, Islam was never an intellectual threat for the Vedic tradition, although it ruled India for so many centuries. But when the Christians came to India, they, because they had science and technology, which gave them an aura of intellectual superiority, so then when they look down on, you worship such an immoral God, then that disturbed Indians. So then, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and especially Bhaktisiddhanta Swami Thakur, he said that you cannot just trespass into the 10th canto. If people are born in a culture where there is reverence, proper reverence, then one understands and one approaches and understands Krishna appropriately. But when one doesn't have that culture of reverence, one only has a culture of skepticism. So then, when one approaches that attitude, then Krishna's pastimes cannot be easily understood. So, now actually speaking, we are in one sense caught in the cross current of both. Now culturally, we belong to India. Intellectually, we belong to the West. In the sense that, culturally, you know, we have been part of the society where Krishna has been worshipped. Most of us probably, you know, we grew with stories of Ram and Krishna being heard, whatever. Of course, that culture is also rapidly disappearing nowadays. Recently, I was asked to give a school program. So there, and I asked about, do you know Narasimha? The only Narasimha they knew was a former Prime Minister of India. So even the culture is getting lost, but at least in the previous generations it was there largely. But intellectually, the educational system is based on Western rationality and humanism. And that's why we also to some extent have that skeptical, cynical attitude. And that's why we need proper caution when we approach the 10th canto. But ultimately we have to approach the 10th canto. So as we study the Bhagavatam and then we come forward, Prabhupada has given us Krishna book, and then his purpose was what? You know, his Krishna book was meant to be like a trailer. You know, the Krishna book itself gives Krishna's pastimes, but Prabhupada also wanted that. It is a summary study of the 10th canto, and he wanted that the 10th canto be studied systematically by devotees. So Satsarup Maharaj once asked Prabhupada, what do you mean by summary study? Prabhupada, when he does the Bhagavatam or the Bhagavad Gita, you know, he has Sanskrit, then he has the verse-to-verse translation, then he has the word-to-word translation, then he's in translation, then purport. So what is summary study? So Prabhupada, summary study means, I do whatever I want. So you wonder, what does it mean, I do whatever I want? Now if you see, in the 31st chapter of the 10th canto, that is the Gopi Gita. So when the Gopi Gita is being described, at that time Prabhupada's description of the Gopi Gita, it starts in Prabhupada, there are 19 verses there. So Prabhupada gives the translations of those verses, and then suddenly at one particular time Prabhupada stops and he says, in this way the gopis chanted, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. Now we may wonder, you know, where the gopis chanted Hare Krishna over there. If you go, somebody may be skeptical, cynical, you will go 10th canto. Where is the reference to Hare Krishna? Look at all the Sanskrit. There is no Hare Krishna. What has Prabhupada done over here? Somebody may ask like that. Actually, whenever a translation is to be done, translation is always a balancing act between precision and relevance. Precision means stating precisely exactly what is said in the original. And relevance means speaking it in a way that people can understand. So, you know, there is Sambandha, there is Abhideya, and there is Prayojan. Sambandha means philosophical knowledge of our relationship with Krishna. Abhideya means the practical means by which one can fix the mind on Krishna. And Prayojan means the mature development of love of God, the rich experience of love for Krishna. Now, Sambandha, Jnana, never changes. it remains the same. It always remains the same because ultimately we are servants of Krishna. But abhidheya, the method of fixing the mind on Krishna, will change. According to time, place, circumstance, it will change. See, we see our acharyas themselves, they demonstrate this. Rupa Goswami and Sanatan Goswami, they were at a very respected position in the Islamic government. And they renounced that to go to Vrindavan and focus on writing literature. Now, we see Bhaktivinoda Thakur was also in a similar position, was in a very respected position in the British government. Now, in one sense, both governments were non-devotional. But we see that Rupa and Sanatan Goswami, they renounced their governmental position. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur stayed on in the governmental position. And still, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is called as the seventh Goswami. So, why is that? Because the way one can practice bhakti and share bhakti with others will vary according to time, place, circumstance. So abhideya will change. You know, when Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when in Bengal, Vaishnavism, although there was some persecution, overall, there was a broad culture of Vaishnavism that was there. And the devotees were practicing the bhakti at that time. And we see that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did not ask any of the devotees at that time in the Navadvip Bengal area to construct any big temples. Why? Because there was the persecution that was there, and now kirtan is something which can be very easily done and easily stopped. But if you have deities and temple, it cannot be easily dismantled or removed. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu focused on sankirtan. But deity worship is also a very important part. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu asked Rupa and Sanatan, at one level, they are renouncing the world, demonstrates Tyaktva Turuna Mashesha Mandalpati, renouncing everything for the sake of Krishna. But another level, you know, Rupa and Sanatan, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted that they use their political savvy for ensuring the redevelopment of Vrindavan. Now, Vrindavan was dangerously close to Delhi, which was the center of the Islamic power. So, Rupa and Sanatan, and after that, Jiva Goswami, by being present over there, they ensured that Vrindavan was restored in its glory. So, there, they did the service by renouncing the world. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he lived at a time when the renunciates were not much respected. Because the Bhadraloka, the people who were educated from the West, educated in Western education, they did not respect the renunciates much. But they respected a person who had education, who had a position, and if such a person was talking about Vaishnavism, they took him seriously. So, abhideya, how one fixes the mind on Krishna, will vary according to time, place, circumstance. So, in the Krishna book, when Prabhupada says that the gopis were chanting Hare Krishna, what does that mean? Prabhupada is giving us the abhideya for doing in essence what the gopis were doing. The gopis were essentially remembering Krishna in separation from him. So we too can remember him in separation from him by chanting Hare Krishna. So Prabhupada gives us access to the 10th canto through the Krishna book. And right in the first chapter itself, first chapter of the first canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says that the serious student to study not just his commentaries, even Priyasacharya's commentaries. And that list he gives not just Gaudiya Vaishnava commentaries, he quotes even Vallabhacharya. And he quotes other Sampradaya's Acharya's commentaries also. So the point is, Prabhupada has given us entry into the 10th canto. And what we have is not, when we are cautious about the 10th canto, that is not phobic. That is ensuring that we enter into 10th canto with a proper understanding. So I'll conclude with one point about what we mean by the proper understanding. I just mentioned earlier about transmoral and immoral. Another way of understanding this is that whenever we hear any story, at that time there is a identification that we do. And for example, if we see some drama or if we watch some movie or read some novel, then we connect with some character in the novel, in that particular narrative. And then if we identify with that, then we start getting emotionally involved in what is happening in that story. So, normally speaking, when we have, when we start studying any, reading any story, now we come with the mood of the enjoyer. That means, say, if we study Krishna's pastimes, we identify with Krishna. Identify with Krishna doesn't necessarily mean that we identify with Krishna literally. We identify with Krishna as the enjoyer. And the great devotees, when they hear Krishna's pastimes, they don't identify with Krishna. They identify with the gopis. Identifying with the gopis doesn't mean that males start thinking they are females. Identifying with the gopis means we understand that I am a devotee and the gopis are the paramount devotees. So, if we approach Krishna, if to the extent we can go beyond the filter of seeing Krishna simply as a male and gopis as females, and we can see Krishna as the Lord and the gopis as devotees, to that extent, we will be able to appreciate and relish how these pastimes are pastimes of pure love. Now, when from Krishna's perspective, now whether he is embracing Uddhava, he is embracing Arjuna, or whether he is embracing Radharani, it's all the same. Same in the sense that they are all his devotees. But when we have a material vision, we are not able to see it all as the same. We start thinking, maybe this is just an ordinary male-female relationship. So as we become purified, what happens is, we start seeing ourselves not as the enjoyer, but as the enjoyed. Not as the Lord, but as the devotee. And to the extent, when we hear Krishna's pastimes, to the extent we can identify with the gopis, to that extent what will happen is, that hearing these pastimes will eradicate lust from the heart. How will it eradicate lust? In fact, the Bhagavatam itself promises this at the end of the 10th canto, or Panchadhyaya. Vikriditam rajavadhuviridam cha vishnu shraddhanvito anushunayadata varnayedya. If one hears this faithfully, then what happens? Bhaktim param bhagvati pratilabhya kamam. We'll get pure devotion. And then, rudrogamashva apahinoti. The rudroga, the heart disease of lust will be eradicated. So how exactly will this happen? That the heart disease of lust will be eradicated by hearing the pastimes of Krishna with the gopis, which seem to be like lust itself. Because they are not lust. They are the origin from which the world, the lust of the world has come. The Bhagavad Gita 15.1 talks about this world as a reflection of the spiritual world. Urdhva Moolam Adha Shakam. So there's an upside down tree. Now, so the male-female attraction, which is the basis of all material attachments in this world, that is like the reflection. It's like the reflection. And it is very attractive. A person is desperately hungry and a person sees a reflection of a mango. What will happen? The person will just dive into that river to try to get that mango. And all that will happen is, no matter how much one tries, one will not get the mango at all. But then, if the person is told, hey, don't dive into that river. I'm starving. I need something to eat. How will I not? So just telling people that, you know, don't be attracted to worldly things, that doesn't work. What the Bhagavatam tells us is, this is a reflection, but there is a reality also. So the reality is, there is a tree and there is a real mango. The real mango is the relationship between the soul and Krishna. And to the extent we understand, okay, this is a reflection and there is no substance over here. That is the substance. And then we feel inspired to move toward the substance. And actually just moving toward the substance itself purifies us. It gives us progressively deeper and richer happiness. And that's how we become detached. Now, the mistake that can happen is, instead of the reflection reminding us of the reality can remind us of the reflection. That means that when we see Radha Krishna's pastimes, you know, sometimes a young boy and a young girl may come to a temple and they look at Radha Krishna. Oh, Radha Krishna are there, we are here. So, they start thinking it's essentially the same. So, if we are not properly philosophically educated and devotionally purified, then the reality reminds us of the reflection. And when the reality reminds us of the reflection, that can have two responses. Either is, we use it to justify immorality. If Krishna does that with the gopis, then why can't I? We use it to justify immorality, or we use it to justify superiority. You worship, like the, as I said, the Western people did, you worship an immoral God. What kind of morality do you have? But both attitudes are wrong, because they don't recognize the difference between the reflection and the reality. And by systematically studying the philosophy, and by gradually becoming purified by the practice of bhakti, we clearly understand the difference between the reflection and the reality. And then, eventually, as we become progressively more and more attracted to the reality, then we become freed from lust. So, what Krishna is revealing in the 10th canto, whether it be in the pastimes of the gopis, or the Parasapanchadhyay, or here, it is in the memories of the pastimes of the gopis, all that is meant to redirect us from reflection to reality through progressive philosophical education and devotional purification. So Srila Prabhupada also demonstrated that same mode of sarva dharman parityajya. How do you do that? You know, for it is said many places that when a person becomes old, if a person goes to a holy place, one should never leave that holy place. The only time a person should leave the holy place is when one leaves that body in the holy place. So people take a vratta. I will stay in Vrindavan, I will stay in Kashi. And similarly, it says sannyasi should not travel across the oceans. But all these rules are there. Prabhupada respected those rules. But for him, there was a higher rule. The higher rule is that Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's prophecy has to be fulfilled. My spiritual master's instruction has to be followed. And sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam. So Prabhupada demonstrated that surrender to Krishna by carrying out the instructions of Krishna as manifested through Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his spiritual master. And through that, he is offering all of us entry into the intimate pastimes of Krishna. So we don't have to imagine ourselves to be deprived of Krishna bhakti, nor do we have to imagine ourselves as to be already spiritually advanced and probing into intimate pastimes. We practice the process of Krishna consciousness that is given to us, and as we keep practicing, we will become purified more and more, and then we will become spiritually attracted to Krishna. Not just sentimentally or materially attracted. Oh, Krishna's pastimes seem more interesting to me. No, spiritually attracted. That means the attraction to Krishna will progressively free us from material attractions. And that attraction is what will ultimately take us back to Krishna. So Krishna's pastimes are not just the trailer. They are also the trail. The trailer means a glimpse of what is to come. Trail means path. By remembering Krishna's pastimes, by remembering Krishna and developing attraction to Krishna, they comprise the path by which we will return back to Him. So they are the trailer as well as the trail. So I'll summarize what I discussed. I started by talking about the background narrative to this 10th canto, 47th chapter. So how Krishna has sent a very his heart is in Vrindavan and he's feeling separation. So he has sent a confidential associate. And Uddhava recognizes the exalted position of the gopis. And that's why he says, Rahaskara, I am a confidential associate, and that I am giving you, you are very respectable, Bhavati Naam. And then we discussed about how Krishna, how the 10th canto is confidential, not in the sense that there are some physical or textual delimiters, that no entry allowed in 10th canto, but it is our misconceptions, which were not present in the past, which came in primarily because of a skeptical approach towards the devotional literature, which came from the Western education, Western rationality and humanism. And we have to remove those misconceptions. So Prabhupada helps us to remove some of those misconceptions through his Krishna book. And as talked about how abhideya, how we fix the mind in Krishna will change according to time, place, circumstance. So we fix the mind in Krishna not just by thinking about some Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, but as Prabhupada said, by doing practical service. Krishna wants me to do something for him. We are essentially doing the same activity, fixing the mind in Krishna. And by thus fixing the mind in Krishna, we'll become purified. And then we'll realize how Krishna's pastimes with the gopis are not immoral, but transmoral. And how will that happen? When we understand, when we, while hearing Krishna's pastimes, don't identify ourselves as the enjoyer, but as the enjoyer, not as the Lord, but as the devotee. And to that extent, we become philosophically educated and devotionally purified, then we won't mistake, we won't equate the reality to the reflection, nor will the reality remind us of the reflection. Rather, we'll move away from the reflection and move towards reality, where by meditating on Krishna's pastimes, which serve as the trail and the trailer, we will relish life and love eternally. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Kaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Itai Gaur Premanande. Jai.